As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time, the Roast of Tom Brady, a Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart, the seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady, live only on Netflix.
Well, on the heels of five Game 7s, five fairly epic Game 7s, Grantcher and I will begin this latest episode of the VanCast by arguing about what we started on Twitter last night, my friend. Of course, Grantcher says, well, every higher seed won and every division winner won. And
no, not every higher seed won. In fairness, two teams that are recent cup winners managed to upset the opponents that were higher seeded, and they were higher seeded by an average of 4.5 points. So,
yeah, so they're close. I get it.
Only the final eight, it includes five elite teams, an additional, by my estimation, five genuine elite teams, another team that had 110 points in the New York Rangers, and whose opponent was down to their third string goaltender and lost their best forward for the majority of the series.
And was up 3-1.
Yeah, but they're 110-point team. This isn't some Cinderella story, right?
Yeah, no, I get it.
And the 104-point team with the best player in the world.
Yeah, and through all of that, we still had...
Sorry. And the 109-point team that won the Cup 3 years ago and just generates scoring chances like no other team, more efficiently than any other team in hockey, despite the fact that they don't really have an elite 5-on-5 gear.
So we can justify all of them. However, we still had five game sevens.
Yep.
Two of those games went into overtime. Four of those games are one goal games. One of the games was a two goal game. These were close games that could have gone either way. These outcomes were not predictable. Hell, you went 4-4 in the first round in your predictions.
Yeah.
So,
well, I don't take chalk. I don't take chalk.
What's that?
I don't just take chalk. Sometimes I pick matchup specific ones where I'm like, well, I don't think this team's as good, but I think the Kings can frustrate the Oilers. I think that aged pretty well, even if I got it wrong. Right.
But the point is, the Kings could have won that series. They were in position to win that series.
Well, and then they got stomped 6-2 on aggregate in the deciding games.
Drancher. The Dallas Stars got stomped in Game 7 based on everything other than the first 10 minutes
destroyed of
overtime. And in that first 10 minutes of overtime, they had the game on their stick repeatedly.
Wow.
And we could be singing a completely different tune
in overtime, Farhan.
We could completely sing a different tune. Sagan had this puck on his stick. We had, Pavelski late in the third period, had a breakaway, got stopped. I mean, it could have gone that way. It's like... bad teams can find ways to win. Underdogs can find ways to win. Now, I'm with you. They can't go on a run all the way to the end.
Well, then, so that's the point, really.
No, it's not the point.
That is the point. Because, Farhan, this sport is so unpredictable and so variable on a micro level that, of course, anything can happen in one game. Anything can happen in one playoff series. There's no debating that. Of course. It's just
yeah, but
you can't extrapolate. You can't extrapolate that to say that once you get in and anything can happen with anything to imply you could get hot and win the Stanley Cup.
Yeah, but you use the first round results to say, yeah, because anything can happen. Now, anything doesn't always turn into winning the cup. And that's the thing is that, you know, it's always been about building a cup team. And that you totally make sense. You don't make a team to just sneak in the playoffs and go on a run.
Correct.
But when you get to that point, when you get to that point where you just want to get in, you use those examples of anything can happen. Because, you know, here's the one thing, and the Toronto Maple Leafs are living proof of this. Actually, I shouldn't say they are because they never get past the first round. But the deeper into a round it gets, and the closer they get to it, the more it hurts, right? So if you're the Montreal Canadiens and you get all the way to the Stanley Cup final, yeah, for those players, you get that close and you lose, it hurts. But that run is something the city absolutely loved. And those moments matter. And they didn't win at the end, but every round they celebrated. And every round you had your sea of whatever they want to call it in any given city with your plaza parties. And it's awesome. And fans cling to that. They love every minute of that.
As they should.
You can't dismiss that by saying, well, it was predictable. The Cinderella, it was clock, was going to strike midnight, right?
I'm not dismissing that, Farhan. I'm not dismissing
that.
Well,
it feels like you are.
Well, but I'm not. It only feels like I am because people react like babies when I say this. Because it's not about don't enjoy the playoff run that your team has.
You're right? Saying it was pointless.
I'm not saying it's pointless. I'm saying this. I'm saying that the way the Montreal Canadiens were constructed, right? And the way the Toronto Maple Leafs were constructed in the 2021 season, right? The Montreal Canadiens win and that series remarkably, right? They go on to the cup final. They play an unbelievable series against Vegas. And then they need overtime to win one game in the final. And now they're rebuilding. Their GM's gone. Their coach is gone. There was nothing sustainable about that. And so, yeah, enjoy it in the moment for sure. But know that that wasn't a cup team, right? Like, know that. And they did. They figured that out pretty quick this season. Right. Obviously, there's extenuating circumstances with Shea Weber, with Carey Price. But here's the thing that, you know, needs to be remembered, right? Like, it's not the team that has, you know, that has the dog in them the way the Montreal Canadiens did for 2-3 months. That's going to be your next cup winner. Like, your next cup winner is going to be the loser team that can't get it done in the playoffs for a long stretch, right? Like the loser team that's there knocking on the door with an elite core and a good supporting cast and the right pieces, and they get in the playoffs and year after year, they fall short. And if you do that for long enough, if you knock on the door for long enough, you become the St. Louis Blues, right? You become the Washington Capitals. You become the Tampa Bay Lightning. Now, not guaranteed. Right. We know that the Vancouver Canucks had an elite core and was there year after year after year, knocking on the door 2 decades ago a decade ago. And they didn't get it done. The San Jose Sharks did it for 15 years. Didn't get to the mountaintop. But that's how hard it is to win the cup. That's how hard it is to win the cup. You have to have everything you need. Elite goaltending, or at least goaltending that gives you elite performance in the playoffs. Stellar supporting cast, elite core. You need all of that. And then you also need all the stars to align for you in terms of the bracket, in terms of the matchups, in terms of your injury luck. You need all of that stuff to go your way all at once. And then you win. And then you masterfully win. And then from then on, you're the team with the playoff gumption, the way the Washington Capitals looked against the Florida Panthers this year, right? Or the Tampa Bay Lightning looked against the Toronto Maple Leafs. Like, all of a sudden, the narrative flips and everyone forgets all of the disappointments you endured on your way up the climb. Like, the point is not that it doesn't matter when a team goes on a miracle run. Like, I probably am not doing this job if not for a miracle run that the Canucks have in 94. Like, obviously, that mattered a ton to 7-year-old me. I genuinely don't think I'd be here if I hadn't seen how that run moved people. So I'm not immune to that. And it's not that I'm making fun of anyone for enjoying or rooting on their team, no matter how good their team is. I mean, I still pick the LA Kings. They're one, what, the third least likely team in the playoffs to win the cup. But don't confuse the team that gets hot at the right time in the playoffs with a team that actually has a shot at winning the cup, right? Like, don't, and certainly when an executive tells you this, when an executive trying to sell you their plan says, well, anything can happen when you make what you get in and anything can happen. No, it can't. You have to be a great team to win. You have to be an elite team to win. And an elite team, by the way, wins in both the regular season and the playoffs. Like, it's not different. The teams that win in the playoffs aren't different than the teams that win in the regular season. The great teams win all the time because they're great. It's baffling to me that this take is remotely controversial. The Stanley Cup is not given to mediocre teams. You have to be a great team to win it. Go build a great team. Go root for that.
Anything can happen is different than winning a Stanley Cup. And that's the whole point of it all, right? Is that think anything can happen if it doesn't, if it falls short of a Stanley Cup?
Just get in. Hang on,
let me finish. You had a run. Let me finish.
I'm just saying that's not true.
But that's how your first tweet
came
across.
I'll let you finish so long as you're not lying.
when you look at last night's games, you know, like those teams, we've seen teams go on a run, and it's funny because we talk about the Washington Capitals; they could never get out of the second round. And we looked at that team when they finally got over the hump and won. It almost felt like a run because very little was expected of that team going into the playoffs. Why? Because they never win. And then all of a sudden, they got the goaltending they finally needed. You know, the coach kind of, you know, pulled off some magic in terms of just his experience. And, you know, one-shot deal as that coach for that team at that time. They got in. And then they haven't made any kind of a run. They haven't got back to a conference final. Right? The St. Louis Blues, they were knocking on the door. Once they won, guess what happened the next year? They lost to the Vancouver Canucks. You know, so when you talk about sustained excellence, right, it doesn't always equate that way, right? Sometimes you can just get there, but it isn't always indicative of who you are, because it's who you are, what you were until you got there, or is it what you show after? The Kings were nothing. They got into the playoffs end. Listen, for all the underlying metrics around the Kings, they barely snuck into the playoffs. And it's crazy to think that the trade deadline turned their team around. And we talk about how teams are built. That team got over the top based on what they did at the deadline. If they didn't do what they did at the deadline, they wouldn't have got into the playoffs. But then all of a sudden, we looked at them.
08-09 Canucks, a massive scare with an incredibly young team in the playoffs the year prior. And they were poised to make the playoffs until a massive injury to Kopitar derailed their season the next year in 09-10. Like, anyone paying attention to hockey knew that this Kings team was a team on the rise. Then they start and it was 10-11, they missed the playoffs. 09, they give the Canucks that massive scare in the first round. Wayne Simmons the ice.
They lost in six games, yeah.
They lost in six games, but they were unbelievable, right? Like, it took that Henrik Sedin. You remember that Henrik Sedin end-to-end goal? Like,
no, it
they
took
were
the Alex Edler hit. It took the Alex Edler taking one game over.
I mean,
the Kings
were awesome in that series. That was not, and that was a Canucks team good enough to, like, meaningfully win, right? I mean, they bumped into the Blackhawks. The Blackhawks win go all the way to the conference final that year. The conference final that year, like, that Canucks team was good enough to make real noise if they'd gotten by Chicago. They were up 3-1 against Chicago, right? And
they lost that series in six.
They were up 2-1 and had a lead with 90 seconds to play against Chicago. And then Patrick Kane intercepts the Willie Mitchell pass. Anyway, neither here nor there. We're not reliving Canucks playoff disappointments of the past. The Kings, though, were a team on the rise for a couple of years prior to that. And then they acquired Mike Richards, and they couldn't score, and they had a slow start. And then after they got Jeff Carter, they were the best team in hockey. And everyone paying attention to the underlying numbers knew that.
But they,
we all did.
They made the playoffs by a point.
I hear you. I know what you're saying.
No,
I
but
hear
you're
you.
Not, because, like, it turned...
They were safely in on the last day of the season. the San Jose Sharks and them were jockeying for position. They were jockeying for position.
Drancher, the last day of the season, anything could have happened in the weeks leading up to that that would have kept that team out of the playoffs. So then, maybe they
were
a
58% fucking control of shot attempts team, like we all knew what this team was.
They were so close to missing. Like, they were still so close to missing. So, like, that has to matter somehow, right? Like, you don't think some luck happened along the way just to get them in?
Well, sure.
And they needed a big time player to be added to that roster at the deadline.
Luck is the everyday.
And then everything changed because then their power play went crazy right after the trade deadline. Once they made that change, their power play went crazy.
you're focusing on the micro.
Yeah, but that's because they got in on the micro. They got in on the micro, and now we're calling them an elite team. And look, for me, they backed it up because 2 years later they won
again.
In
2014, Farhan.
That's what I just said. I go, they backed it up because they won again 2 years later.
They were dominant, and you could see it. You could see it. This isn't hindsight. I picked them to win. I called them over. I said the Canucks were overmatched before that series.
Yeah, and what happened also going into that series? No Daniel Sedin available.
Yeah. And I picked them thinking before I thought Daniel Sedin was going to miss the playoffs. If you go read that piece assumes Daniel in. I'm not saying Daniel's out so they're going to win. That's not the logic. The logic is I think Daniel's in and the Canucks are overmatched.
Yeah, listen, you certainly for me, I saw the Canucks ripe for an upset. And we're doing a Canuck podcast, so we can get into that. Because at the end of the year, they forgot how to score. I remember listening to Henrik Sedin interviews afterwards telling me when they won 2-1 that, yeah, this is exactly how we need to play. We need to show we can win these kind of games in the playoffs. And I'm like, you guys don't know how to score. And this is fiction to think that this team is what it was last year, even though they won the President's Trophy. So as I saw it, and you know, I remember seeing all the big time prognosticators because you weren't big time then like you are now. And the only person of note that picked the Canucks, or sorry, that picked the Kings was Helene Elliott, if you can believe it. And I know she wasn't following the analytics trail, but look, I could see that being ripe for an upset, and I'll give you that because the Kings backed it up 2 years later by winning again. Right. So I'll give you that.
They were one of the teams of the first part of the decade. I mean, and you could see it happening. You could see it coming. The Kings were not a Cinderella. They were an elite team that started slow. The Blues were not a Cinderella. They were an elite team that started slow.
Yeah, I don't know that they were elite yet. Like you couldn't call them that until they made the freaking trade. Right. Like they weren't an elite team. And I know they had the injury, but you can't call them that until they got to that point.
They still needed
Jonathan Quick to stand on his
head. I called them that before the series.
Yeah, but I don't know that you were right in that moment. Hindsight may prove you right, or they just may have gotten better and they may have been able to sustain it. But I don't think you can say a team that needed to get into the playoffs on the final day of the year was an elite team. A team that all of a sudden turned its season around based on some moves they made at the trade deadline. It's hard to call that, saying, yep, it was always an elite team. It wasn't always an elite team. Became elite.
This is a game. This is a game that takes the most unpredictable route possible to logical conclusions. That's what hockey is. Game to game, 10 games, anything can happen, right? The best team in the league can go 1-9. The worst team in the league can go 9-1. We see it every year, right? This is a game that takes the most unpredictable possible path to logical conclusions. It's only as the sample expands, right, that quality and talent win out. And that's what makes the playoffs so cruel. You can be a 113-point team, right, with a 38-8 record at home, and you can, or a 38-5 record at home, or whatever the Wild had, and you can get into the playoffs, and it can last six games. Six games. It's so cruel. You can have the best team in the 100-year history of the Toronto Maple Leafs, and you're out in seven for the fifth consecutive season. Right?
That's awesome.
Or you can survive just long enough, partly due to luck, partly due to talent. You survive long enough that you actually need to play 25 games to win the Stanley Cup. And when you have to play 25 games to win the Stanley Cup, talent matters. All of a sudden, control matters. Team quality matters, right? It's this amazing thing. The tournament is short and arbitrary, and yet lasts long enough that you need to be great to actually win it. That's how this works. That's how this works. So you can't go in there aiming for eighth. And, you know, as that, if that's your bar, because I remember, do you remember a couple of years ago, I asked Jim Benning specifically, I was like, why does your organization never talk about winning the cup? And his answer was, you first you have to get in and then anything can happen. Right. And it's something that's echoed by executives across the league. It fundamentally is used to justify mediocrity, and it's a pleasant lie told to fans. You know, the reaction that I get is people being like, well, you're taking all the fun out of sports, like taking all the fun out of the game. It's like, really? Like, I have fun drinking a beer and watching the game. I barely miss these playoff games. I can't wait to watch them. And I view this way. Like, it's still fun to enjoy with my family. You know, it's still a killer to go to a game, you know, take my nephew, go with buddies. Like, it's amazing. Like, hockey is so fast. It's so thrilling. The fact that I don't think that some chump team that got lucky, the fact that I don't think the Dallas Stars had a hope in hell of winning the Stanley Cup. And yeah, sure, they got it to overtime, but man, were they outclassed. It took them 60 minutes to have as many shot attempts as the Calgary Flames had in 22.
Yeah,
22
were,
minutes.
There were two like, earlier games cow. In that series. There were two earlier games in that series in 5 and 6 where they were clearly the better team.
But yeah, right? Again, anything can happen. One game.
So
over the total estimation of that series, the Dallas Stars got a historic goaltending performance. Probably the best goaltending performance of the last 15 years.
That was incredible.
And all it got them was a first round exit.
Hey,
like
look,
if you get that lucky and don't win, you suck. You suck.
Look, I think we all predicted that Calgary was going to win this series, but the bottom line is we could be here doing this podcast with 3 out of 5 different results. Like, the games were that close. The overtimes were that close, right? Marginal call gives the Rangers a power play. You know, like, the games were that close, and they could have gone the other way. And then you got 2 more weeks to live, and you are 1,000% right. I will tell you this, like, a bad team can't win the cup, right?
Yeah.
And the Dallas Stars 2 years ago went and did this, right? So how did we view the Dallas Stars? Some people viewed them as a bad team. Others said, well, you know what? Like, and you saw my predictions before the game. I'm like, God, they were the only team with a negative goal differential. And I know those aren't the numbers that matter to you, but I looked at it and I'm like, this team barely got in. And when you just look at the math across the board, I mean, they shouldn't have been there, but they were that close. And 2 years ago, the same core got to the Stanley Cup final, losing to a really, really good elite Tampa Bay team. So now you look at this team and they're like, they've been there before. This core has been able to get through the playoffs and get all the way to the end. And it didn't happen, but when teams go on those kinds of runs, when they get an opportunity to go through that again, you kind of look at them a little bit differently. And I don't think any of us thought they were deep enough to win the Stanley Cup, but you and I could be having this conversation differently because those games were that close and they could have gone that way. And none of those teams that lost really had the opportunity to win the cup. I think Minnesota, in my opinion, I shouldn't say that. Obviously, Toronto is talented enough that they could have gone that way, but their goaltending simply wasn't good enough. It was going to bite them in the ass at some point, right? But
you think, you know, so?
Yeah, like it wasn't good enough.
It didn't bite them in the ass this round.
It didn't, but it would have at some point. And just like you say, like if you were to gauge 1 through 16, the starting goaltenders in the playoffs, Campbell's down in the bottom 3 of the 16 teams that made the playoffs. Based on your thoughts on his ability to win and carry his team and win those games that needed to get won, even by an elite team, right? If the Kings were elite, Jonathan Quick was ridiculous.
Well, sure, but Jonathan Quick was an average regular season goalie.
No, but in like the playoffs, his career, he stood on his head, and Jack Campbell wasn't doing that.
Jonathan Quick's greatest attribute was that he never really got hurt for very long, ever. And so he was an average goaltender year after year who played 65 games and never got hurt. And so he was always available. And so the fact that he was, you know, some years he would be great, some years he wouldn't be great. But over the sum total of it, he was like a 915 goaltender in an era with elevated save percentage. And turned out to be that was hugely valuable. And then he got hot at the right time 2 times in his career and won 2 cups and will be remembered as, you know, one of the great, if not the greatest American goaltender to ever play. And he deserves that, by the way, because availability and the ability to get hot when it matters, to be that big game goalie, was the best at taking the bottom of the net. But like, there was no stage of his career where Jonathan Quick was as good as Henrik Lundqvist or Roberto Luongo, and he has rings and they don't, right? I mean, that's, again, the nature of this cruel game. Jack Campbell, you know, Jack Campbell's career 916 goaltender, having faced just about 4,000 shots. Thatcher Demko, who we talk about as the next one in Vancouver, and I don't think we're wrong to talk about him that way, right? Like, we talk about him, and not just we, NHL talent evaluators talk about him as a fringe top five goalie, right? Has a 912 career save percentage on just over 4,000 shots faced.
Yeah, we've just seen him almost steal a series in the playoffs, right?
Well, but I'm saying the gap between them is huge, considering that Jack Campbell's career numbers are higher. I don't think of Jack Campbell as being bottom three. I think of him as a pretty good goaltender. I think of him...
I'm talking about bottom three of the 16 that are in the playoffs.
No, I know, and I don't think of him that way. I think of Jack Campbell as, you know, in and around the top 10 with just as good a chance of getting hot as anyone else.
Yeah, we just have never seen it, though.
Like, and if they'd won that round, I mean, first of all, he was just as good as Andrei Vasilevskiy in that series, right?
And well, Vasilevskiy ran hot and cold. He had some really, like, the games they lost, you kind of raised your eyebrows. In the games they won, he was really, really outstanding.
Yeah, and even in some of the games they won. And if the Leafs had won, you'd have gone into that series, Campbell versus Bobrovsky, and I would have said I like Toronto's goaltending better.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 U.S.-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service anytime. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
All right, Brent Drancher, let's look ahead now. Do we want to get into Bruce Boudreau now, or do we want to get into the Battle of Alberta? Let's do Boudreau before we get too deep into a Canuck podcast. It's done. We touched on it last week. He's been involved in recruitment of players. Everybody has said the right things at that press conference. He was on the golf course having a grand old time. You know, the comments that really struck me were when he was asked, I think it was Kevin Willie that asked him the basic questions about the criticism he received from management. And, you know, he said that he essentially, I'm paraphrasing, that he wasn't paying enough attention to the numbers, but the numbers as they related to the structure and as they related to the exits and the reliance on the goaltender, because he was too busy trying to win games. But that he is going to try and focus on those things a little bit more. He'll have a full camp under his belt and so on. What did you make of his essentially self-effacing reaction to it all?
Yeah, it showed good humility. Boudreau always comes off as amiable and relatable. And so, you know, I think it was a good answer, but I do wonder if there's going to be a sort of divide here going forward in terms of what the goals of various people within the organization are. And this is sort of my concern with Boudreau coming back, particularly on a one-year deal. Like, this is a guy who loves to coach. This is a guy who wants the opportunity to coach. And he's very good at it, right? No question. He knows how to win games. But if this team is trying to achieve something beyond just winning anything, get in and anything can happen, if they're trying to build a great team and a great process-driven organization, well, I do think what you need is more than just the 2 points night to night, right? Like you need to begin to install, you know, a system that wins you games in a sustainable manner. You need to, you know, have a variety of sort of player development things that are well thought out and executed with alignment and discipline. And in the case of Boudreaux coming back as a coach who, you know, is coaching for his next contract next season, and a front office that's certainly making noises like they're focused pretty firmly on the long term, I do sort of wonder about that fit. And if the analytics talking point is just sort of the public tip of the iceberg on a larger misalignment in how this team is viewed between management and coach. And you know, I say that also knowing full well that I think a little bit of clash is helpful and useful and necessary in hockey, right? Like you have to have, and you'll always have, a coach who, you know, looks up and down his bench and sees like a bunch of guys he trusts late in games, like to use the Tyler Mott analogy, right? Who sees a Tyler Mott and says, oh boy, he drives my third line. He's crucial on the PK. I send him over the bench like a first liner when we're leading late. I need that guy, right? And you also, and that's fine, like a coach does need that guy, but a manager needs to know that they can replace that player. I need to get the third and I'll get you Brad Richardson, right? I don't think that's an unhealthy dynamic. But if there's a more significant misalignment in terms of what this organization's long-term goals are, and if Bruce Boudreaux's on a one-year deal and isn't incentivized to think about that, then I do think you run into, you know, at least a risk of a more substantive misalignment that could be unhelpful for all involved next season.
So, you know, we've identified areas the Canucks need improvement, right? Particularly on the back end, and there's some other areas. But if you're
can I just say, like, watching this playoffs, you know what else the Canucks need improvement in? They need some heavier guys.
Well, didn't we talk about that earlier in the year? About they need some heft to what they're doing, especially when you see them play teams like Minnesota, who ultimately didn't advance. Where does that fall in the pecking
order? not just them, like Calgary, I think LA.
But where does it fall in the pecking order relative to the other needs that they have? Like that doesn't all of a sudden get to the top of the list.
Pretty high up for me, man. Like I'd say
that's not
what
you said earlier when we had this discussion.
Yeah, I just don't think they have enough functional toughness.
I'm not saying they need
Nick Delorier. I still think their stick on puck game allows them to match up better with bigger teams than with fast teams. Like, I think what I said last time was speed's the bigger priority to me, right?
Correct.
And that's still true. But they need both.
Hard to get both in one off season.
Well, for sure. I mean, hard to get both and upgrade your blue line in one off season, particularly when you don't have a ton of cap space. And I'm dropping a cap column later, so we'll get into that shortly. But yeah, I mean, watching these playoffs, I'm struck by, you know, over seven games, I do think this roster, as it's currently constructed, would get worn down pretty significantly.
Yeah, Drancher, I mean, it's hard to argue, especially on the toughness meter, because ultimately Luke Shen became this team's only tough guy. And there were times they wore down as the season progressed, right? I mean, you saw the injuries pile up for a team that outside of COVID was incredibly healthy all year. I know that Pettersson started out slow, but, you know, in terms of key players lost for extended periods of time, this team didn't have that. They had a few hiccups with, you know, Brock Besser along the way and the COVID piece, but it wasn't until the end when they started losing Horvat and, you know, and it's this team started feeling it a little bit later in the year. And yeah, you knew at some point they were going to wear down. Their luck wasn't going to be able to continue. And they need more than Luke Shen, because then you're playing him an inordinate amount of time and putting his role up there where it shouldn't be. But it's tough. I mean, this team has a lot of needs. So my question to you is, we have a sense of what this team's needs are. Based on Bruce Boudreaux and how he likes to coach, right? We know he's not a heavy matchup guy, but based on his style over a myriad of stops, not just Vancouver, what does Bruce Boudreaux think the Canucks' needs are? One, let's just say Boudreaux's top two needs. Go.
More creative defensemen. A. B. I think more speed and more size. On the depth, on especially among his depth forwards.
Yeah, I mean, certainly when you look at how they wanted to forecheck, and when you look at what that third line at one point with Mott and Highmore and Lamico were able to give them, and not that those guys are elite, elite skaters, but they're certainly, they look elite on this roster.
Sorry, who are you talking to, Mott and Highmore?
Yeah, like I'm just saying that line was able to play with speed.
Having those guys, like team speed is such a fickle thing that having those guys in the lineup, and you know, you'll remember they weren't in for some of the Canucks' worst stretches
for sure
in the first 25. But all of a sudden you put those guys in and you put them in your top nine, and all of a sudden this team wasn't getting crushed or skated off the ice by faster teams. They still had trouble with those faster teams, but it wasn't just a, you knew it was coming pounding night after night. And yeah, I mean, I it's amazing the impact that one or two fast guys replacing one or two non-fast guys, like, when those guys come in and replace Chiasson and, you know, Dowling, right? It's just like, oh boy, wow, this looks like a totally different team. It's something you have to be so careful about. It's something that I thought would get Tampa skated off the ice in the first round, is that they, I thought, didn't have enough fast guys with how they sort of changed their roster. Now, they found ways to slow it down. They found ways to grind it out. I now am more confident that Tampa Bay can beat the Panthers. In fact, I'm picking the Lightning now as a result. But just because it didn't happen. It didn't happen. Like, it didn't happen against the Maple Leafs. I don't think the Panthers are going to be able to skate them off. And as such, I think Tampa has a shot now. So good for them. The fact is, though, is that team speed is a very, very fickle thing. You have to be very, very careful with it. And the Canucks don't have enough of it. But you can rebuild it really fast if you get two or three guys who can really move and replace some guys who can't with those bodies.
You wanted to get into salary cap and where the Canucks are and potentially creative ways to get out of it, because we keep hearing reports about Canucks having talks about one of their two high-priced defensemen.
Well, yeah, and me and Rick at The Athletic on Friday sort of poured a little bit of cold water on the OEL thing. I think the OEL thing is unlikely. And not just because of the obvious reasons structurally. Like, I think the team was really happy with his performance this season. One thing that I think is interesting, I think there's a sense that the club needs to upgrade the right side of their defense. Not a huge shock. But I think that the overall right side question will be dramatically impacted by what happens with Tucker Pullman. And I think management in particular really likes Tucker Pullman, like, a lot more than, you know, certainly the way that we chatted about him this season would indicate we do. Right. Like, I think there's this thought that, you know, if you add Pullman with Oliver Ekman-Larsson, could that be a top four pair? Potentially, right? If you have Pullman with Dermott, is that a really good third pair? Like an advantage for you? I think there's the thought that it could be. So I don't necessarily disagree with that. I think when you look at Rutherford's blue lines historically, there's been a lot of guys like that. Like, you know, isn't Pullman just a better skating right-handed version of Brian Dumoulin at the end of the day? I mean, there's not a huge difference there for me. So I can see why that would be the analysis, or that would be the internal viewpoint. But I think there's real concern about Pullman's status. And his agent told Dollywall and I last week that Pullman's trending well. I hope, for his sake, like, just as a human being, I hope that that's right. I hope that he's able to resume his playing career, his Canucks career, as normal next season. But in the event that he's not, and even in the event that he is, I think the right side remains a real area of concern for this team. I think there's a desire to have Myers slotted a little further down the lineup, or at least, like, even if he's your top pair 5-on-5 defenseman, at least not playing as much as he was last season. I think there's a desire to insulate him better. And certainly if Pullman's out, I think there's a real concern about how they fill that. And one thing that I won't be stunned to see, Farhan, is if the Canucks go out in free agency, if they look around the market, if they don't see a lot they like, and I can tell you now, I don't think they see a lot they like necessarily, or at least not a lot they like that they think they'll be able to afford, right? I wouldn't be stunned if we see Ekman-Larsson get a significant run, a significant look on the right side next season.
Wow. Yeah, and you know, I don't know what his history is playing as offside.
He's done it.
Yeah, and how has he done it?
Yeah, he's done okay.
Meh. And would you potentially pair him with Quinn Hughes?
I mean, I that's what I'd do.
Probably the best way to insulate him.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, and the best way to get more out of him offensively.
And do you think there's much discussion about Myers? And we've talked about the fact that next year he becomes much more tradable. But if they are looking to move cap space and they are looking to upgrade, but again, you're taking one out of your right side, which you a player you think can play as long as he's not playing the minutes and role that he currently is. Do you think there's much in the way of dialogue as far as that player is concerned?
I'm not exactly sure. I think the club, so I've modeled it out, and I do this every year. I do my my annual cap modeling column. And here's where the Canucks are at going into this offseason. It's not really a cap crunch. For the first time in a long time, the Canucks are going into this offseason and won't need to... They will not need to like perform roster surgery to upgrade this lineup for the first time in 3 years. Certainly for the first offseason that I've covered the team will go into this offseason with enough cap flexibility that you could make those tweaks that Boudreaux wants, that you could make some upgrades, that you could meaningfully improve this roster for next season without buying out a Jason Dickinson, without reallocating cap space or any of those highfalutin concepts we like to bring up. The way it breaks down really is that the Canucks will go into this offseason without having made a single move. And I've modeled it out. I give them $66.9 million in space committed to 17 skaters, which leaves them with $15.6 million to sign six players to flesh out the roster, right? This assumes, of course, that Michael Ferlin remains on LTI. Now, that's not bad. 15.6, you can sort of stretch that out a bit, but you know, once you do Besser, at somewhere between $6.5 to $7.5 million, right? And then obviously you're going to have Rathbone, Lamico, and Highmore in at something like $800,000 to $1 million, right? Between them, each basically. The 15.8 goes fast, and so I sort of model them as having somewhere between $5.5 to $6.5 million in functional cap space with which to sign two players. So there you go. That's money that you can use to meaningfully upgrade, right? Like if you want a tough minutes defenseman, well, you've got some money to do it. Like, you've got some money to acquire a guy in a trade. You've got some money to go out and spend in free agency. You've got some money to send out a guy and take back more salary in return, right? Which might be a way to get off a Dickinson or a way to get off, you know, one of the Canucks' inefficient contracts. That's without making a salary cap shedding move, right? About $5.5 to $6.5 million to play with two or three players to sign, right? And obviously, you can add $1 million, basically, if you're going out to sign three. So it would be $6.5 to $7.5 million for three guys. Well, that's pretty good. Like, that's, you know, two good middle six forwards, and you can sort of place a lottery ticket on a defender. And yet, the Canucks have to be really careful, because where things are going to get tight for them is next season, right? Beyond this year, when you've got Besser expiring, you've got Miller and Horvat, and then you've got to start positioning yourself for Pettersson's expiry in the summer of 2024. Right now, with a Brock Besser extension plugged in at, let's say, $6.5 million, 3 years, right? That's low, but let's plug that in, because that's what the evolving hockey model has in terms of his most likely cap hit in terms of their contract projection model. So let's plug 6.5 in for Besser. So if we go look at the summer of 2023, we're looking at a team that's going to have 12 guys signed and $28.5 million in cap space, right? That could go up to 30 if you buy out Dickinson, but $28.5 million. And that sounds great, right? Like, that sounds awesome. But say you use five of the $5.5 million to $6.5 million in cap space that they have this summer on a deal for a guy that lasts, or a deal for two guys that lasts for more than 1 year. So you're making a multi-year commitment this summer, which you're going to need to do if you're upgrading this roster, right? So you right away take $5.5 million off of that 28.5. Now, are you extending Horvat and Miller? We'll take another 16 out, 16 and a half maybe. All of a sudden, you're back to $7 million. You've got 14 or 15 players signed, and you've got Rathbone, Hoaglander, Dermott, and if the club is lucky enough to get him, Kuzmenko, all to extend. Well, all of a sudden, you're right back where you started. Cap crunch. So this is like a moment where the Canucks have real cap flexibility short term, and yet they have to be really careful about it. They have to be really disciplined for the first time ever in eschewing the win now mentality that, should it continue, will only guarantee that this team wins never in terms of how they manage this. This has to be an offseason in which Vancouver's newfound cap flexibility is treated very much like the fragile thing it is, as opposed to, you know, the club freewheeling into a moment in which they actually are entering the offseason with some ability to upgrade their roster without going through the rigmarole that they've had to in the past.
All right, let's take one more break. And when we come back, we'll talk about some of the coaching moves and look ahead to round two of the Stanley Cup playoffs.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
So, Drancher, I want to get into the Battle of Alberta in a second, but let's talk coaching real quick. I'm not expecting the Leafs to make wholesale changes. I think Sheldon Keefe is still going to be this team's coach. I think Dubas is still going to be this team's GM. You see any scenario where they blow these guys out because of what's happened in these playoffs?
I mean, I do, because the frustration there has mounted to such a high level. In terms of the market, right? In terms of, now, I know that media guys were all lining up to say, like, well, they can't make changes. Look how well they played. But I'm sure there's a fair bit of internal frustration. Now, the Toronto situation is really interesting because it's very different from what you have in most NHL markets, right? Like, the Maple Leafs are effectively owned by a conglomerate of, like, a board of technocrats. Right? This is not a one emotional billionaire sort of making all the decisions, although I know Larry Tannenbaum sort of ascendant among those board members. This is a more business-minded enterprise, I think it's fair to say, than what you have in some NHL markets, where if you lost in the first round 5 consecutive years, some emotional owner would be like, you don't have the stuff. There's not enough dog in you. Right? Is that a fair description?
Oh, for sure. Yeah. The fact that it's owned differently allows for a measured approach.
A measured approach and a quantitative approach. So, you know, in the past, for example, we know that Kyle Dubas has gone to the MLSE board and explained what PDO is, right? Like, they've been brought along slowly in terms of how this team wants to approach winning, and how they want to approach winning is build an elite core, keep it together, surround it with talent as best we can, and give ourselves as many shots as we can to get lucky. And they haven't gotten lucky, and maybe there's something more going on there. You're certainly well within your rights to suggest there's not enough dog in them at this point. But in that situation, I could see the board saying, okay, right? Like, okay, we liked how that went. We think you guys played well. We think we're close to something here. Let's go. Keep going. You're still in charge.
What about Brendan Shanahan, though?
Well, Kyle Dubas was his guy.
Kyle Dubas was his guy. You know, brought him in at a really young age, took a huge leap of faith onto the analytics side. You know, and I think there was a feeling when Dubas was hired that, look, if we don't do it now and put him in this position, somebody else will. He's that well regarded around the league. But, you know, he's the guy that's got to go to that board and make the case. Do you think he changes his mind at all?
Well, he is the guy who goes to the board. You know, I'd imagine the dynamic is very interesting at the moment because of the frustration level and because I'm sure everyone is annoyed. I'm sure everyone wants to win, right? I mean, everyone wants to win, especially guys as competitive as Shanahan and Dubas. So, you know, I don't think it's fait accompli that things stay the same. I think there could be some changes. We'll see. Like, we'll see how that plays out. But, you know, I think at this point, I'd be pretty surprised. I'd be pretty surprised with how they played that, you know, that they threw the baby out with the bathwater. And in the event that they decided to fire Dubas anyway, I mean, I think that would be a massive mistake. Like, it, same thing with the Wild and Bill Guerin, right? I know everyone was sort of gnashing their teeth after the Wild lost in seven. And understandably, fair enough. But with, like, with the way the NHL works now, the whole test is, can you find guys? Like, can you find guys affordably who can play at a high level to complement your team, right? And you look at Minnesota, and it's like this constant flow of affordable talent that contributes at a really high level for them. Like, you look at Kulikov, you look at John Merrill, the way that they filled the gaps on their blue line, Ryan Hartman, Frederick Gaudreau, a top six center they got for in the scrap heap. You look at Toronto, Kasha, Kampf, Bunting. I mean, the contributions they got from guys mined for basically nothing in free agency, and they do it every year. They do it every year. The Wild have done it multiple years. Why have the Pittsburgh Penguins had so much success? That's the main reason. Like, in the hard cap era, for me, that's the GM's primary task. The team building thing where you go out and consistently find high-level contributors affordably within your cap structure. Fit as much talent as you can on the ice under the upper limit of the salary cap. And for me, like, Guerin and Dubas are guys who I know do it year after year. Like, they're sharps at the table. I just don't think you should. I don't think you can lose those guys willy nilly, because that's the hardest thing to do. And those guys nail it consistently year after year, which is why I have a fair bit of regard for them. So, you know, for me, I think they'd be making a mistake. I don't think you want to lose that guy, particularly at a pretty crucial juncture for your organization. And I think Dubas would have opportunities immediately. So, you know, we'll see where this goes. I would not expect significant changes, but I also wouldn't be shocked by them.
A couple of things before we, I do want to talk to you a bit about Pete DeBoer getting let go in Vegas, but Rick Dhaliwal is posting, and I don't know if this is ahead of their show, just a conversation he had with Jim Rutherford earlier today. Let's see. Brock Besser on Besser's contract. Hard to say right now on conversations with his agent. They're ongoing. We continue to work away at that. Rutherford on analytics. It's part of how decisions are made. It's also about what we see, and the group thinks analytics is not the final way we make decisions. On Kuzmenko, we'll give it our best shot, see where it goes. We've given him the reasons to come to Vancouver. And on the playoffs and what he's seen, it's confirmation on what we need to do. Play with structure. You cannot win playing wide open hockey. I still like a lot of the things we're doing here. Anything jump out at you?
Nope. All expected. I mean, the Besser thing, you know, we sort of reported that there was some positive signs, but I don't want anyone to confuse that with, you know, a sense that this is going to be easy. It's not. And there's still a very real possibility that this ends up with Besser accepting his qualifying offer, right? Like, these are going to be tough talks, but I do expect those talks to heat up this week. You know, further. And I think that's sort of the most urgent priority now, in it, now that the Kuzmenko pitch is done and Bruce Boudreau's coming back. I think the majority of the club's efforts will turn to Besser. And then I think Miller and Horvat thereafter. You know, I think the club would really like to know what extensions look like for those guys. And you know, I just laid out that cap sort of dynamics, the club's cap positioning to you. It makes sense when you look at it, right? Why the club would think that that's so vital here. I think that'll be sort of characterizing much of the next couple months, and then we'll get into the off season and see where they go.
Rutherford on Miller, the final decision on him doesn't have to be made until the trade deadline, but we'll know more in the summer. Reiterates that Miller, Besser, and Horvat, those are the big three. So no shock there. I mean, they certainly have those options with Miller. If you're Miller's camp, you want to get it done this summer, coming off a 99-point season. You don't want to wait until next year and try to renegotiate at that point. And, you know, for the Canucks, you've got different value points if you move them now versus moving them at the deadline. But, you know, they've got that flexibility and they can see where they're at as a team, but it becomes dangerous, right? If you're right on the cusp of the playoffs and you don't have anything done with Miller at that point, like, you can't take the chance
to let him go for nothing. Like, you just can't do
definitely.
That.
Definitely. Well, I mean, yeah, I think you probably want to make a decision this summer. And while Rutherford said we do have time, the final decision doesn't have to be made until the deadline. We want to have a sense of it before that. I think that indicates a pretty wide-eyed view about where this is going, right? The club needs to have that figured out prior to the end of this offseason, in my view.
Pete DeBoer gone in Vegas. I don't think we're overly surprised based on the way they've been trending and how things went down this year. Barry Trotz was replaced, I guess, by Lane Lambert in Long Island. Trotz obviously isn't going to be coming to Vancouver because Bruce Boudreau is staying. But does Vegas become the logical landing spot, or does he wind up going back to Nashville?
Oh, interesting. Yeah, I mean, I think it's got to be Vegas. Would you Trotz back in Nashville? I don't know.
Well,
about that.
People like there's people in Nashville that when the decisions
first happened, I mean, he's locked there. He should
back.
Be.
Yeah.
But also, I mean, Nashville feels like a team that needs to turn the page, and forward, not backward, and always twirling toward freedom. Vegas makes a ton of sense to me. I wonder if they'll back up the Brinks truck there. They probably should.
Yeah, I don't disagree. Let's talk about the next round, and let's talk Battle of Alberta to start. Who do you like? For me, and we'll get Danielle to write these down so that we know which ones you got wrong and right, because it's only elite teams that are going to advance.
Correct.
Calgary is just far more complete. The Tanev thing makes me a little bit nervous.
I think
it matters a lot to that team. I don't know what you're hearing in terms of his availability later on in these playoffs, but that is a far more complete team with far more elite goaltending. And regardless of how good Connor McDavid is, Calgary should win this series.
Yeah, I agree. I think I've got Calgary, but I've got them in seven. Like, I think it's going to be a long series. Now, seven's partly a hedge because I don't know what's up with Tanev.
Tanev.
But one thing I'll say is if you're going to make your edge in net hold up, you can't have Eric Gudbranson taking 14 shot attempts under any circumstances the way he did in Game 7.
Fair.
You know, like, as good as Ottinger was, when Mark Stone and Eric Gudbranson are leading your team in shot attempts, you're also putting a goalie in a position to look unbelievable.
Oh, stay in the West, and let's go Colorado and St. Louis. The Blues have any chance in this?
I don't think so. I've got Colorado in five.
Me as
gentlemen
well.
Gentlemen sweep.
Me as well. Let's go to the East, and we'll start with the Rangers in Carolina. I'm taking Carolina.
Oh, yeah. The shots are going to be 45-20 every game. And, you know, Shesterkin might still make it last six, but Carolina is materially better. I'm picking them in five.
And last but not least, the Tampa Bay Lightning team, which broke your Maple Leafs hearts against your former employers. With Florida holding home ice advantage, who do you like in the Battle of Florida, which will probably be better hockey than the Battle of Alberta, if not the same level of emotion?
I'm going to take six. I'm going to take Tampa in six. I think
Tampa in six.
Yeah, I was prepared to take Florida, but I didn't like how Florida played against Washington. I thought Washington frustrated them immensely with a pretty basic 1-3-1. I thought the Panthers struggled to play the game that was in front of them. And while they still eventually overpowered a team that, you know, whose best days are behind it, like if the Washington Capitals are cagey enough to frustrate you that way, to make you require three pretty hefty comeback victories to win the series in six, well, the Tampa Bay Lightning are a cagier version of that with far better goaltending. You can't play with fire like that against this Tampa Bay Lightning team. I just don't know. I just don't know if the Florida Panthers, like the Florida Panthers to me, the way they played in that first round, I worry that they're the team that everyone thinks Toronto is in terms of their readiness to win, right? And we'll see. I think the Lightning are going to have enough curveballs, enough changeups, enough off-speed stuff to overcome, you know, the fact that their fastball is very hittable by a Florida Panthers team.
I'm going to take Florida to win just because we can't have all the same picks. But
right.
Yeah,
it's so
Florida.
Unpredictable. Anything can happen, right, Farhan?
Well, no, they're both.
They're both
exceptional teams.
You're deviating. Yeah, no, that's the one series with two elite teams. But The overall thrust here is, you know, we're picking all elite teams to advance. Like, of my five elite teams remaining, you and I have agreed that four of them will advance. And the only series we disagree is when two of them are competing. Which brings us back to where we started, and in full agreement, you with me.
I'm going to let you go. We'll do this again on Wednesday. Look, if you're looking for other pod options that don't involve Thomas Drantz, check out a much more, you know, measured, intelligent approach from Ian Mendez and Julian McKenzie as they recap the first round of the Stanley Cup playoffs and preview the second round Monday on the Athletic Hockey Show. As for us, say thanks for listening, or in this case, thanks for listening to us yell at each other in the first segment. Please follow us on your favorite podcast platform. Don't forget to leave a rating and a review. And right now, you can get an annual subscription to The Athletic for just $1 a month for 6 months when you visit theathletic.com/vancast. We'll be back on Wednesday, which is day one of round two. And it should be a lot of fun this second round of the playoffs because, you know, we've got five elite teams and we're picking the same teams to win, except for in one case where each of us is picking an elite team. So we may do a live room later in the week. If not, we may get a guest as well. So, but one way or the other, we will be back Wednesday for Drantzer. I'm Farhan. Thanks for logging on. Thanks for tuning in.